I want to speak to you about a spiritual and a historical view of the war on terror. Now, we know about the war on terror. It started in President Bush's first term, and it continues through even to today. It's a long-lasting war that has extended over a number of years and through several terms of presidencies. But it's not a new thing in American history. We actually had a war on terror 200 years ago under several famous founding fathers, and we'll talk about that later. But in talking about both the spiritual and the historical view of the war on terror, let's start with where we are right now. The way we see the war on terror is much through the lens and through the eyes of the reporters that are sent overseas to report about the war on terror. We're also able to see it through some foreign reporting through, for example, the British broadcasting system. Sometimes on cable, we get the Canadian broadcasting system, others talking about the war on terror, and we get our version from what we see on the news. And so the pictures that are sent back to us from that region of the world, and by the way, it involves so many nations that are around the Mediterranean Sea, those in North Africa, from Egypt, as you move on around the Mediterranean Sea, moving to the east, you have from Egypt to Saudi Arabia, and you have Kuwait, and you move on up into Iraq and Afghanistan, and you move over into Iran and all these other nations. So that is a big part of the war on terror, is around the Mediterranean Sea. So we see regular pictures of military troops, and we have embedded reporters that go with those troops. And of all the years that they have been sending pictures back about the war on terror, probably the most frequently recurring picture that comes into our homes is the pictures of military funerals. We see the caskets unloaded off the planes. We see the site at Arlington Cemetery and local cemeteries as these warriors are entombed permanently there in the ground as the coffins are lowered. We see the weeping families. And a number of the networks actually keep a rolling scroll bar on how many are now lost in the war on terror. 13 more today, 7 last week, 63 in this latest bomb blast, whatever it is. They just keep a running tally. So it's constantly before our eyes that we are losing Americans, that we're losing our soldiers, and that's consistently what we see. And we rarely get more than that. And so our perception about the war on terror is this has been a very costly war, a lot of lives that have been lost. It's really not gaining us anything. And that is the perception that's come across. Now, having told us where we currently are, let me go to a Bible verse. Proverbs 18:17 says very simply, "He who states his case first seems right until someone tells the other side and sets the record straight." And there is another side to the war on terror. There's another side to what we have right now. And there is also the side of both a spiritual and a historical view. But let's start a little bit with what we have right now. One of my close friends that has been on multiple tours over in the war on terror, he's returned. He lives down in southern Florida. He is Jerry Walton, and Jerry's in Special Forces. As a matter of fact, I think he's 56 years old. He's in Special Forces. He is the oldest Special Force guy in America, which is kind of cool. I think if I was going to war and I was a young guy going to war, I would follow him. I mean, he's been through everything, and he's survived everything, and he's a wily fighter. And Jerry is also a photographer. And so in addition to being part of Special Forces, he has photography that's displayed at the Pentagon, that's used at the Pentagon. And so when he returned from his last trip, he gave me a disc full of all of these photographs he had taken. And we just sat down, we had dinner together, and we went over and looked at the photographs. And these are the ones that were declassified that he could show me. There was a lot that he couldn't show me. But even in just what he was showing me, I was seeing these cars that were blowing up, the car bombs going off. He's there as it actually happens. And then I see that the devastation of the apartment buildings and the house buildings as a car bomb has gone off near one and they've collapsed. And you actually see the body in the rubble. And then there's all these pictures of the bad guys that they bring in. He goes out to get the bad guys. And if they can't bring them in, if the bad guys want to fight, well, then they'll fight them. They try to bring them in and bring them to justice. And going through and looking at all those photos, all the guys involved, all the units involved, how many bad guys they're bringing in. And then even as he was showing me some of the things that are happening over there, for example, one set of the pictures dealt with the girls that are going to school now in Afghanistan and Iraq. Now, girls haven't been going to school there, but since the Americans have come in and we've chased the Taliban out and got Al-Qaeda on the move backwards, they've now started schools for these young girls. And a lot of these Islamic terrorists do not want these girls being educated, which is really where the world was 600, 700 years ago during the Dark Ages when Christians weren't being educated. And so if you're not educated, it's a lot easier to lead the masses. And so whether it was in church or state, they would tell all the masses, this is what God wants you to do, so go do this. And then as the Reformation came along and we got into starting to read again and we got into reading the Bible, we said, wait a minute, the leaders are wrong. And so education's always been a problem for dictatorial and for despotic and for tyrannical leaders. And so these guys in Afghanistan and Iraq are not liking the fact that these young girls are being educated. And so what they started doing was targeting these schools, just flat blowing up schools where these girls are going, young girls going to school. And this has nothing to do with blowing up Americans, and they're trying to get these invaders out of their country. Now, they don't want these girls being educated. And so Jerry had a number of pictures showing a lot of these girls being treated in hospitals, and you know, it's tragic stuff. They're just covered with blood and bombs that have gone off in their schools, et cetera. And Jerry said, you know, one of the ways that we know that we're winning the war over there, and he pointed to the school, and he pointed to a picture of the guy that they had captured who's been blowing up those schools. He said, the way we know that we're winning is the women turn this guy into us. He said, the women want their girls educated. The women want their children protected. And they're the ones who finger this guy who's been blowing up the schools. Well, that's really good, but we don't hear that kind of cooperation. It's the American outsiders that are imposing their will. Now, you've got a lot of people in that nation that want a different form of life, and they're helping the Americans to take out the bad guys. So, you know, I don't hear any of that on the media. And then as we were going through a number of the other pictures, man, there were all sorts of insurgents that were lying dead on the streets. These guys that have come after the Americans, bombs in hand, guns in hands. And Jerry was saying, I tell my guys that we're going to try to take them alive, but if they come shooting, we're going to shoot back. And as I was just looking at the number of bodies that were laying there, I said, Jerry, you know, we're hearing about the American lives that are lost. I've heard nothing about these lives that were trying to kill Americans and kill the women and the girls and the others. And I said, you know, just looking at the pictures, looks to me like we must be taking them out at a rate of about 50 to 1, that for every American we're losing, we must be taking out about 50 of these guys trying to murder others. He said, oh, no. He said it's much higher than that, higher than 50 to 1. My goodness, we hear nothing about that. Now, if the media were to suddenly tell us that, you know, we've lost 3,000 American casualties, but there's been 200,000 of these murderers, these guys trying to do car bombs and blow up girls and blow up schools, that we've taken out 200,000 murderers. Now, that would give a different complexion, but we hear nothing about that. It appears to be a one-sided loss, but it definitely is not. And I've also seen that from talking to so many others that have gone over. One of my friends came back from Iraq recently. He was a chaplain, and he is with the troops and out with the troops. And he said that when they were over there, he actually went in to get a haircut. And he took one of his buddies with him. They went in to get a haircut. And so this Iraqi barber gave them a haircut. And he was getting ready to pay this barber $20 for each haircut. He thought that would be a very fair price. It's maybe a little more than what they might pay in the United States, but it's very fair, and he wanted to be fair with the guy. So he's turned to give this barber $40. Now, he didn't know it then, but he found out later that $20 is about a month's wages in Iraq. So he's about to pay this guy 2 months' wages for two haircuts. And this guy said, I'm not taking your money. And the chaplain said, oh, it's fine. Go ahead. Take it. You know, you gave us the haircut. We don't pay for it. He said, no, I'm not taking your money. And the chaplain said, no, take it. And the guy got real indignant, says, I am not taking your money. He said, you bought our freedom. I will not pay you for buying our freedom. This is a way I can say thank you. Now, we hear nothing about that. A guy willing to say no to 2 months' wages just so he can say thank you for buying my freedom. And he told me that as the troops walked down the streets, it's really touching because you get all these kids running up to him, and these kids come running up, and they don't know much English, but what they say is, autograph, autograph. And they'll hold up a pen to the soldiers. And what they want is an autograph from the soldiers and nothing to write on. So the soldiers simply write their name on the kids' arms. And those kids go back. That's our hero. It's like getting a signature from a great athlete or a rock star or something else. And these kids are just thrilled to get the signatures, the autographs of these freedom fighters. But that's not the perception we get. So we get one side of this thing that the media wants, you know, make this thing really look bad. Let's get out of here. This is not accomplishing anything. And that's not accurate. But whether you look at Nightline or CBS or Newsweek or the New York Times, or whether you look at U.S. News and World Report or NPR or PBS or anything else, you get a steady diet of, well, this is not going well. And that's the public perception that's formed. And as a matter of fact, I was talking to one of the soldiers that was going back to his second trip into Iraq, and he's going back, and he's an officer, he's over a unit, and as he gets back, there are embedded reporters with these units. That's the way that they've decided that they can keep the reporters safe. This is to embed them with the unit and let them go out. And so when he got back, he said that these reporters came to him and said, "Sir," he said, "please don't let us get killed." And the reporter saying, "This is officer," and he looks at him and said, "What do you mean, let you get killed?" He said, we're asking you, please don't let us get killed." He said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well," he said, "we're with CNN. We're embedded with your unit, and we'll be going out with you. And you need to know right up front that CNN has told us that we are not allowed to give any positive stories on anything that happens. We've got to somehow find ways to make this look bad. And we know that could really bother you guys. And we know that you guys could turn your backs on us and walk off in a heartbeat and we would be dead." He said, but please don't let us get killed. He said, "You need to understand this is not what we want to do. This is what we're being told that we need to do." And so I get reports like that back, which we certainly don't get on the news. But if you watch the news, yeah, it's a steady diet of negative reports. And that builds a public perception. Now, what's significant about public perception? Well, psychologists have documented that public perception is very, very important, and that it has a whole lot of impact on how other people think. And there's a great classic example of where a psychologist did a test that dealt with public perception. And they brought people in, and they brought them and set them down and said, "Now, we're going to show you three lines, and we want you to choose which line is the longest, line A, B, or C." And it was real obvious, real easy to tell. It's like, you know, one line might be 3 inches long, and one line might be 6 inches long, but one line's like 2 feet long. So it's real easy to tell which is the longest line. It was not a trick question. And they brought them in and said, "Now, we're going to show you three lines. Is A, B, or C the longest?" And they show you another group, and is A, B, C, or the longest? And another group, and is it A, B, or C? So they show them these lines in groups of three, and each time they ask you, raise your hand on the line that's the longest. Well, what they did was they broke the groups down, broke all the folks down into groups of 10. They put them in groups of 10 and said, "Now, when we show you these groups of three lines, we want you to raise your hand on which line is the longest." And again, it was real easy to tell which is the longest line of the three. It was not a trick question. But what they did was 9 out of the 10 people in the group were plants. And 9 out of the 10 people had been told that when we show you the second longest line, we want you to raise your hand there as if it is the longest line. We want to see what that one person is going to do when faced with the pressure of 9 other people who clearly are saying something wrong. That one person, it's obvious which line is longest, but everybody else in the room is going to be saying that a different line is longest. And so we're going to put 9 of you in there as plants with one person who doesn't know what's going on, and we're going to see what they do when they get to the longest line. Will they say that indeed the longest line is the longest line, or will they change it to vote with the rest of you? And so in doing this, with 9 out of the 10 being plants, what they found at the end of this test was that 75% of the people were willing to change their vote and say, no, the second longest line is actually the longest. I want to be with everybody else. I don't want to look different from everybody else. I'm going to vote the way everybody else is voting. And so that was the power of public perception. If you perceive that everybody else is saying this, everybody else is doing this, everyone else's voice is saying this, well, I don't want to be strange out there and say, well, you know, it's really not happening that way. There's another, no, I'm going to go with everybody else, even though I know that's not what I really believe. And so that is the power of public perception, and that's where the media does become significant, because it does create perceptions. It does not necessarily report truth. It's not necessarily report falsehood. It just reports things that create perceptions. And as with anyone else, when you give reports, you're going to give reports in a way that favor what you prefer. If I write a newsletter, I'm going to fill that newsletter with things that I think are cool. Now, somebody else may not think those things are very nice, but that's what I think is cool, so that's what I'm putting in the newsletter. Well, it's the same with editors. It's the same with reporters. It's the same with owners of news stations and other entities. They're going to report what their viewpoint is, and that's what we're going to get. So having said that, I point that out to say that in the war on terror that's been going now for a number of years, so much of what happens here in America literally has been shaped by public perception created by images that we see from the media, and quite often we do not get to hear the other side of the story. And by the way, that verse, Proverbs 18:17, is one of the very reasons that in the Bill of Rights we have the provisions and the due process clauses that allow an accused person to confront their accuser. Because if the accuser is the only one that gets to speak, man, they can make a really strong case against the indicted person. But when you get the other side of the story, you say, now, wait a minute, we didn't hear that part. And that's why in law, in the Bill of Rights, we incorporate Proverbs 18:17 to make sure that we get both sides of the story before we make a decision. And before a jury gets to go out and make the decision, they've got to hear both sides of the story. But we often don't do that with the media. So that's public perception. Now, let me take you back into the War on Terror and look at it from a historical and a spiritual historical perspective. There's a great quote given by President Woodrow Wilson. He says, "A nation which does not remember what it was yesterday does not know what it is today, nor what it's trying to do." He said, we're trying to do a futile thing if we don't know where we've come from or what we've been about. Now, that's true. And when you look at the War on Terror and where we are right now in the very region of the country or of the world where that war is being fought, that's not the first time we've been there. Americans have had troops on the ground over there even 200 years ago. Now, again, if I can return to our common public perception right now of that region of the world, what we often get on the news media is all the protests that happen over in the Muslim area of the world, over around the Mediterranean Sea, the eastern shore and the southern shore and the northern shore. We see all these protests that are happening, and even far east of that as you get into Pakistan and other countries as well. You see all these massive protests against Americans. You know, a really interesting thing, and people don't often ask this question when they see it, but you see these protests on TV with all these Muslims marching and carrying signs, and you know, signs like America's the killer of innocent Muslims and George Bush is the world's biggest terrorist and etc. And people don't realize, but you know, those signs are in English. Now think about it for a minute. The region of the country where those protests are going, and sometimes we see protests from across the world. We see them across the islands in Indonesia and micro-Indonesia, and we see them in different parts of Africa. And interesting thing is they don't speak English as their primary language in those nations. And a lot of them don't even speak English as a second language. And yet the signs we see on TV are all in English. Now, why would that be? Why would we be seeing signs in English? Well, again, those other nations, Muslims, know the power of media, and they know the power of the American media, and they're happy to feed stuff into the American media to get the American media to carry it home, and it's their propaganda. And it's interesting that a lot of times you can actually go on the web, and when there's a picture in the newspaper, if you go on the web, you can find that picture, and a lot of times it's a lot larger than what you see on the newspaper. The newspaper will show the signs how they're really angry at America. And if you back out on the newsprint, you'll actually see that most of the signs are printed in Arabic, which is the common language for so many of these folks protesting. But what we see in America is the American signs, as though, you know, that was what the whole protest was about, and it's just not that. So again, perception does make a difference, and if you only know one side of the story, it creates a perception. Now, going back to the historical view of this, what we rarely recognize today is that, as I mentioned, this is our second time to be in this region of the world fighting Muslim terrorists. And in the first time, we spent 32 years being at war with Muslim terrorists. It was called the Barbary Powers War, and we rarely hear about that in textbooks today. But that war against Muslim terrorists began at the end of the American Revolution, and it went through four different presidencies: President George Washington, President John Adams, President Thomas Jefferson, and President James Madison all had to fight against Muslim terrorists during their administrations. And it was a situation where that at the time of the American Revolution, there was international law that had been established for centuries. Legal writers like Grotius and Pufendorf and others had helped establish international law, and all the nations kind of got along that international law. And international law said, well, when you're out in the open seas belong to everybody, and here's the amount of miles off your shore that belongs to you. These are your territorial waters, but once you get out in the deep seas, that everybody's got access to that. And And that was the way it had been in international law forever. Well, American ships had been sailing to Europe, and they'd been sailing throughout the Mediterranean, sailing into Russia, who was an ally with us at that time. And a lot of our economy in the United States was based on shipping and commerce. We would trade what we had in America to other nations, and these commerce ships sailing back and forth. And what happened was, as we would go into these Mediterranean regions, and the Mediterranean Sea joined so many of these Islamic nations, as we went into that region, the American ships, for flying an American flag, were the object of attack by five different Muslim nations. Five different Muslim nations would come after American ships and didn't care that we were in international waters, didn't matter that there was international law. They went after the American ships and they attacked the American ships. And what they would do is they would capture the American sailors, the American crew, and they would imprison them and they would make slaves out of them. As a matter of fact, just this morning, we purchased a newspaper. Now, we're very blessed. We have about 100,000 documents from before 1812, and this morning we added another one, and it was a newspaper from Boston, and it's a newspaper back way back at the time of the early presidents, Madison, Washington, those. And it's a report of one of the guys who's just been captured by these Muslim terrorists. He was a sailor on a ship, and it was a ship that sailed out of Salem, Massachusetts. And so he's on the ship, and they were doing commercial trade. And by the way, when they got attacked by these Muslim terrorists, these commercial ships couldn't defend themselves. I mean, commercial ships might carry three or four cannons on their ship. They didn't need to defend themselves. Everybody recognized international law. They would use these cannons to fire off powder charges in the fog to make sure that other ships knew they were around. But, you know, really defending themselves, that's not what the cannons are for. You didn't need to defend yourself as a commercial sailing ship. You were not a military ship, and that's fine. You can go through waters. But suddenly they'd get attacked with these 40-gun frigates and these 60-gun frigates and these corvette ships that the Muslims had and would come after these commercial ships. And there was just no contest, no way to defend themselves. So in this one particular letter, and by the way, the Muslim terrorists back then were attacking Americans because they said the Americans are Christians, we're Muslims, we're supposed to attack Christians. And so here's the letter. It came out of the Boston Patriot newspaper, and it is from a man named Francis Garcia, and he's writing his dear wife. It's dated September the 1st. I'll just read you a couple lines out of this. He says, "My dear wife," and he tells her that on the 26th of August, they were captured by Algiers, one of the Muslim nations, a ship from them, that they were stripped of all their clothing. And he said, "We're now under the severe lashes of a taskmaster and full of filth and misery." He said, "To see Captain Smith, who's unused to labor, with a heavy burden on his back, as well as myself, doubles the misery of my captivity." He said that they're required to dig stones and drag those huge stones to the arsenal for the Muslims. He said at night, he said, "We retire to this dismal cell where we hear nothing but curses and the like." He said, "We sleep in the rocks and the mire." He went on to say that he talked to the Swedish council, and he said, "The Swedish council has given us some money to buy a second shirt, and he's given us an encouragement that the United States will not forget us." He says, "But as for me, there's no need of any assistance, for death will soon relieve me. But I pray, for Jesus' sake, that some means may be used for those who may survive." He says, "As for ever seeing you again, my dear wife," he said, "it will be in that eternal world where sorrow, I hope, will be quite banished from my troubled mind." He said, "I die in the hope of the promises of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and that he will present us unspotted before his Father. Farewell, all my friends. Farewell, all my relations. Farewell, Salem, Massachusetts. Farewell, America. And last of all, farewell to you, my dear. I remain your loving husband, Francis Garcia." Now, that was a letter from one of these sailors who had been captured by the Muslim terrorist, who managed, the letter managed to make it back to America. And while the Muslim terrorist would enslave these Americans, they soon found out that, you know, if we will just simply take them, not necessarily enslave them, if we'll sell them back to America for ransom, this is a money-making deal. And so they continued to capture the Americans, and any ship that wore an American flag, they would attack. And they started selling the captains back to America for $6,000, the officers for $4,000, and the sailors for $1,500 a head. And that equates, buying a ship back would be about $1 million today. It's about $1 million ransom to buy the crew back off of a ship. And so that's how these Muslim terrorists were financing what they were doing. They were doing this to America. Now, you look at that and say, well, why didn't America do something about it? Real simple. we're in the American Revolution. We don't even have a Navy. How are we going to do anything? I mean, the British Navy was our Navy. We've managed to convince the French to lend us their Navy, but we don't have a Navy. So with these commercial American sailing ships sailing all over the world, how do you defend them? Well, you can't, because we don't have a Navy. So if you can't be defended, when they attack and steal all these Americans and either enslave them or hold them for ransom to sell back, the only option you got is pay the ransom or let them remain in slavery and or be killed. Nothing else you can do. Well, this was becoming such a frequent occurrence on American ships that in 1784, the Continental Congress, now remember, we've finished the American Revolution in 1783, but in 1784, the Continental Congress said, we've got to do something to try to negotiate with these Muslim terrorists. So what they did in 1784 was Congress dispatched the first three diplomats to negotiate with these Muslim terrorists. Those three diplomats were Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and Ben Franklin. They arrived over in Europe. They're dealing particularly with five Islamic nations that are attacking American interests, and they're trying to reach some type of accord with these guys. And so here these three Americans are negotiating with five different nations, and one of the ambassadors, one of the Muslim ambassadors with whom they negotiated, and by the way, three guys having to cover five nations, they had to travel back and forth between the nations a lot, and Adams and Jefferson managed to develop a relationship with one of these Muslim negotiators. And after 2 years of negotiating with this guy, they finally felt comfortable enough to ask him some very candid questions. I mean, we're beyond the diplomatic stage now. We just got to figure out how you think. So help us here. So Adams and Jefferson asked him some questions, and the answers to those questions, they recorded and wrote down and sent back to the United States State Department. Those documents are still at the State Department. You can actually see the documents online. But Jefferson and Adams asked this Muslim negotiator a very simple question. They said, you know, we really don't understand why all the unprovoked attacks on all these American interests. I mean, we've done nothing to you guys. We've had no bad relations with Muslim nations. We certainly have never attacked you in any way. Why are you attacking us? Why all these unprovoked attacks? And here's the answer given by the Muslim ambassador to Jefferson Adams. And again, this is the answer that's in the State Department records. Quote, the ambassador answered us that it was founded on the laws of their prophet Muhammad, that it was written in their Quran that all nations who should not have acknowledged their authority were sinners, and that it was their right and their duty to make war upon them wherever they could be found and to make slaves of all they could take as prisoners, and that every Muslim who should be slain in battle was sure to go to paradise. Now, what they find out is, hey, it's got nothing to do with what America's done to us. This is what we're supposed to do. This is what our holy book tells us to do. We're supposed to attack you guys. We're supposed to make war on you guys. We're supposed to take slaves every time we get the... And by the way, in that period of time, the Muslims took 1.25 million slaves during that period. They're just following what the book tells them to do. That's what our prophet Muhammad told us to do, and that's what's written in the Quran, that we're supposed to subdue every nation that's not Islamic, and we're supposed to make slaves. And so that's what Adams and Jefferson learned for the first time, which is a whole different way of thinking from what they've got. We in America continue to send other negotiators over because there were five nations, and another negotiator that went over was William Eaton. And William Eaton got over, and his correspondence back to the State Department is all recorded, and it's all available for you to see. And William Eaton says the problem over here, he says the Muslims believe that the Americans are a feeble sect of Christians. Now, the significance of that statement is this, is that the Muslims had targeted what they called Christian nations and were attacking Christian nations. And so they were attacking Sweden. They were attacking France. They were attacking Great Britain. They were attacking Norway. They were attacking the United States. The difference is all the other nations had navies and they fought back. Now, the Americans had no navy. We had no military. And so the Muslim, as Eaton said, he said, the Muslims believe that the Americans are a feeble sect of Christians. You guys don't even fight back. We attack you and you don't do anything to us at all. What a bunch of weak, spineless Christians you are. And he said, he continued, this is still William Eaton, he said, it's a maxim of the Muslim states that, quote, the Christians who would be on good terms with them must fight well or pay well. In other words, we're going to attack you because you're Christians, we're Muslims, we're supposed to do that, and you're either going to have to fight us really well or you're going to have to pay us really well. And that's the ransom that we were paying on these ships. And so as our negotiators are over there, Adams and Jefferson and Franklin, we came to reach treaties where we said, okay, we don't hate Muslims and you guys are attacking us, but here's the deal. We'll pay you $1 million a year or $5 million a year, or we'll give you all these things if you'll not attack us. And that was called tribute. We would give them tribute payments, and it was extortion. It was straight out extortion, straight out blackmail. And so we were signing these treaties with all these Muslim nations, and we were having to renew the treaties. And so we would give these annual stipulations. And that's the way it was when George Washington came to office. It's what Congress was doing. And the axiom is that you have to fight well or you have to pay well. Well, he certainly couldn't fight well. The army we did have, we sent home at the end of the American Revolution, and we didn't believe in standing armies back then. I mean, if we needed the army, we would tell them to go get their squirrel guns off the fireplace and come back and fight again. But that was without realizing that there were nations overseas who were beginning to attack us. I mean, we were willing to defend our home ground, and when the British invaded us, we're willing to fight here. But now, Americans in international waters are being attacked elsewhere, and we've got no way to defend them. So we have no military, so the only option we have is to pay well. And you'll find that Washington had to do that, but he did not like it. And as a matter of fact, by the time you get to 1795, which is the next to the last year of his administration, he's in his second term, he's halfway through the second term, and in 1795, amazingly, 16% of the federal budget was spent in dealing with Muslim terrorism. Can you imagine that? 1/6 of the entire federal budget under George Washington was directed at payments to these Muslim terrorists. We don't have an army, so we have to pay. And now 1/6 of the entire federal budget is these extortion payments. And you can imagine Washington was not a happy camper. I mean, he is a soldier. He's been a soldier all of his life. He's used to fighting enemies. Now he's having to pay them. He made a very clear statement. This is what Washington declared. He said, quote, "Would to heaven that we had a navy able to reform those enemies to mankind or to crush them into non-existence." He gave the axiom, he said, to be prepared for war is one of the most effectual means of preserving peace. It was at this point that Washington really took America in a new direction. We didn't have standing armies, didn't believe in standing armies. We now see a need for a standing army. So George Washington says, look, we've got to have a military to defend Americans across the world. And so he went to Congress 1795 and he asked for military appropriations to build a navy. We've got to have a navy so that we can go over there and take care of these terrorists. That's the first time we made any advance toward a permanent military was in 1795 as a result of the war on terror that was going at that time. So 1795, he makes that appeal. Congress approves it. Now, in 1795, George Washington's vice president was John Adams. Now, John Adams has already been a negotiator over there. He's very familiar with that part of the world. And so John Adams now becomes president in 1796. He's elected, sworn in 1797. He becomes president, and he vigorously pursues the building of the United States Navy. As a matter of fact, to this day, John Adams is still called the father of the American Navy. I mean, it all got put together during his administration. Washington starts it, calls for it, gets the first funding started, but Adams really pursues it. Now, here's President Adams. He's seen this. He's seen what's going on. He's finally got a Navy. He can put the Marines on the ship, and the Navy can sell them overseas, and they can take care of those terrorists, and John Adams doesn't do it. Now, why would John Adams not do that? Why would he not go after those terrorists? Well, Adams had been there. He had negotiated with those guys. He knew how they thought. You know what he said? Adams said that he didn't want to send the military over because he didn't think the American people had the stomach for a prolonged war. And he knew that if they got in a war with those terrorists, it was going to last for a while. And he knowing the American people and knowing what the terrorists were like, he knew that if we went after them, it was going to last for a good while. And he just didn't think the American people would stomach that. So he didn't do it. Well, he was a president for 4 years. The next president that comes in is Thomas Jefferson, who was also one of those original negotiators. So here's Jefferson. Now, he's got a Navy, and he's been over there, and Jefferson has a whole different attitude from John Adams. He says, we're going over there, we're going to free those Americans, and we're going to thump those terrorists, and this is not going to happen again. And so he made an announcement of brand new policy. He was no longer going to pay the payments. Washington made the payments. Adams made the payments, but Jefferson's not going to do it. And by the way, when Jefferson came into office, the budget was up to 20% of the federal budget was spent on dealing with Muslim terrorists. So now 1/5 of the federal budget is dealing with Muslim terrorists, and Jefferson said no more. this is his quote. He said, quote, "I was very unwilling that we should acquiesce in the humiliation of paying a tribute. I very early thought it would be best to effect a peace through the medium of war." He said, we're going to have peace, but not by paying. We're going to have peace by sending the Marines and the Navy over there. And so he did. He dispatched the first military expedition, and it went to the same region of the world where we're fighting the war on terror right now. That military expedition was led by General William Eaton. Now, William Eaton had been an early ambassador over there. Now he's been made a general, and he's taken the military over. He's in charge of this military expedition because he's been over there. He's negotiated. He knows them. He knows how they think. He knows that region of the world. He knows the topography, the geography. He knows the culture. So he's leading the military expedition over. There was a second prong that was sent under the command of Commodore Edward Preble. So our first military expedition goes over. We got the brand new Navy sailing the Marines over. And by the way, if you think about the Marine Corps hymn, it says, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. Why Tripoli? Well, Tripoli was one of those five Islamic nations that was attacking the Americans. And so that Tripoli, to the shores of Tripoli, the Marine Corps hymn actually refers to the very first war against Muslim terrorists way back under Thomas Jefferson. So General Eaton gets there. He unloads the Marines. They start marching across the country dealing with the terrorists. And after it was all over, he has the memoirs of his life, and he wrote it all out and told about what happened in that war. And it says that he marched across the desert from Egypt and on through. And he says in his memoirs, on the title of the book, it says, several years an officer in the United States Army, consul or diplomat at the Regency of Tunis on the coast of Barbary, and commander of the Christian and other forces that marched from Egypt through the desert of Barker in 1805, conquered the city of Derna, which led to the Treaty of Peace between the United States and the Regency of Tripoli. Now, Tripoli, interesting title to use. You may have heard something about what's called the Treaty of Tripoli. The Treaty of Tripoli, Alan Combs and other secularists love to cite this. If you say, oh, America has Christian principles, they say, no way. Treaty of Tripoli, done in 1797, says this. Article 11 says the government of the United States is in no sense founded on the Christian religion. So what do you say about that? Well, I was on Alan Combs' radio program for an hour, you know, and that's all he could talk about was, Barton, you're all wrong. Founding fathers weren't Christians, and they didn't have Christian foundations because the Treaty of Tripoli, 1797, says the government of the United States is in no sense founded on the Christian religion. Now, Tripoli was one of those five Muslim nations that was attacking Americans. And I keep pointing out to Alan, you put a period in the middle of the sentence. That's not what Article 11 says. Here's what Article 11 says. The government of the United States is in no sense founded on the Christian religion that has a hatred of the laws, religion, and tranquility of Muslims. What we said is, guys, we're not the Christians that hate Muslims. Now, you've had that in Europe. I mean, we went through the Inquisition and the Crusades, and all these Christian nations were attacking Muslim nations. And so you had the Star Chambers, and you had the torture and the Inquisition where they were, and you had church leaders saying, hey, Christians, you undo something good for Jesus, go find a Muslim, cut his head off. And so that was happening, burning Muslims at the stake. And so the Muslims say, we're repaying all you Christians for what you did to us in the Inquisition and the Crusades and when the Spains expelled the Moors. So we're repaying you for all. And Article 11 of the Treaty of Tripoli says, wait a minute, we're not those Christians. We're not Christians that have a hatred of Muslims. That's not who we are. And in America, we made that real clear. As a matter of fact, Daniel Webster, in comparing American Christianity with European Christianity, he said, fortunately, he said, American Christianity is Christianity to which the sword and the burning stake are unknown. It's general tolerant Christianity that's a law in America. So we don't use burning at the stake. We don't put you to the sword if you don't believe right. American Christianity is not like that. Other founding fathers said the same thing. John Jay, founding father, Supreme Court Chief Justice, the original one, said American Christianity was enlightened when compared to European Christianity. John Adams called American Christianity rational when compared to European Christianity. And John Quincy Adams called American Christianity civilized as compared to the rest of the world. John Adams, John Quincy Adams, John Jay, Webster, all these guys said that. And as a matter of fact, maybe the best summation is given by Thomas Jefferson. This is what Thomas Jefferson said. He said, the comparisons of our government with those in Europe is like a comparison between heaven and hell. I mean, it's that stark. That was the difference. So Article 11 of the Treaty of Tripoli says the government of the United States is in no sense founded on the Christian religions as it has no character of hatred against the laws, religion, tranquility of Muslims. We're not those kind of Christians. So when you hear the Treaty of Tripoli invoked, and secularists love to do that, and I've noticed that recently they've been sending letters to the editors across the nation. It's like an evangelistic campaign they've got, and they keep quoting Article 11 in the Treaty of Tripoli, and most Christians don't know what to say about that or what to do about that. And the thing to do is, hey, guys, quick stop in the sentence midway. Read the rest of it. It says, you guys are Muslims, we're Christians, and the fact we're Christians doesn't mean we hate you just because you're Muslims. That's what Article 11 says. So back to General Eaton. He's over. He's leading the American forces through, and in his day-to-day records and his memoirs, it's really kind of humorous to see what he says. For example, here's an entry from April the 8th. He says, now remember, he's been a diplomat over there already. Now he's coming back militarily. He says, we find it almost impossible to inspire these wild bigots with confidence in us or to persuade them that being Christians, we can be otherwise than enemies to Muslims. We have a difficult undertaking. In other words, we keep telling these guys that, look, just because we're Christians, we don't hate you. But they won't believe that. They keep saying, no, we're Muslims, you're Christians, we have to fight you. And again, that's what the Treaty of Tripoli was about. And that's not the only treaty. There were treaties done with Algiers and with Tunis and with all these other Islamic nations as well. And that was a common clause in it. So that Treaty of Tripoli is completely out of context. But again, here's what Eaton said, is we keep trying to tell them that we're Christians, you're Muslims, and we're not your enemies. But by the time we go from April the 8th, when he wrote that, to May the 23rd, it's like, all right, I'm tired of negotiating. And this is what he says on May the 23rd. The commander-in-chief of the enemy's forces has offered for my head $6,000, which is a bunch of bucks back then, has offered for my head $6,000 and double the sum for me a prisoner and $30 per head for Christians. Why don't he come and take it? That's a great military attitude. All right, he's put a bounty on every one of them. Let's see if he can collect. Come on, let's see if you can collect your bounty on us. So here the Muslims have put a bounty on the head of every Christian. By the way, they still pay bounties today. The last I knew in the war on terror, those who are willing to sacrifice themselves in car bombs or walk into a restaurant and blow themselves up are getting paid about $25,000. That's what their family gets if they blow themselves up. So they're still a bounty. They still pay for that kind of slaughter and death. Nothing new under the sun. But as it turns out, we had in that first conflict, we had 5 years of on-the-ground warfare in that region of the world, right where we are now, and finally we're able to get a first kind of peace treaty signed with Tripoli and some others, and they said, okay, we give up, we're tired of being thumped by the Marines, you can send them back home, we'll be good now. But when you look at Thomas Jefferson had been sent as a diplomat to negotiate with these guys in 1784, and here he is in 1805 finally getting the first peace treaty with them where we no longer have to pay. So you're looking at 21, 22 years that Thomas Jefferson has been negotiating with Muslim terrorists and fighting Muslim terrorists. Now, you may have noticed that back in January of 2007, Keith Ellison was sworn into U.S. Congress from the 5th Congressional District of Minnesota. And when he was sworn in, he took his oath of office on the 1746 Quran owned by Thomas Jefferson. Now, he was called by the media the first Muslim member of the American Congress, and he's sworn in on Jefferson's Quran. You know, why in the heck would Jefferson own a Quran? What's he doing with that? Well, the answer is very simple, and it comes from a principle of war given by the Chinese general 2,000 years ago, Sun Tzu, who said, quote, know your enemy. So in 1786, when Jefferson had asked the question of the Muslim diplomat, said, why do you guys fight us? Well, why these unprovoked attacks on us? And that diplomat said, well, it's written in the Quran. Jefferson said, you got to be kidding. There's actually a book that says that you go to heaven if you kill people? So Jefferson went out and got a Quran to read for himself. He didn't want to trust what somebody else said. He wants to know for himself. So Jefferson got that Quran. He read that Quran in order to learn the mind and the thinking of his enemy, in order to learn how they thought. And so he used that, trying to learn how they thought in his diplomatic proceedings, and finally when he went to war with them. So interestingly, Ellison, when he was sworn in back in 2007 on Jefferson's Quran, says, you know, the fact that this was Jefferson's Quran shows the positive influence that Islam has had on the founding fathers. Wrong. The reason he had the Quran was to learn how to fight the folks who were attacking him, who were Muslim terrorists. So that was a piece of revision that happened. And by the way, another piece of revision was the media said, you know, this is the first Muslim sworn into Congress. Well, you need to go back to 1799. John Randolph of Roanoke. John Randolph Roanoke, who served under all these early presidents, he served under Adams and Jefferson and Madison and Monroe and John Quincy Adams and Jackson, etc., long-term member of Congress. John Randolph of Roanoke, who, by the way, is a descendant of Pocahontas, this is his quote. He said that he held a position, quote, in favor of Mohammedism. In other words, I am a big supporter of Islam. He said he quote, rejoiced in all of its triumphs over the cross of Christianity. Whenever Islam thumped Christianity, he was standing and cheering. He said that he held a position of, quote, natural repugnance to Christianity. So here's John Randolph saying, look, I hate Christianity. I love Islam, and I love it when Islam thumps Christianity. It sounds to me like that might have been our first Muslim member of Congress. This is in 1799. Oh, by the way, he didn't stay a Muslim member of Congress. You may have heard of Francis Scott Key, the guy who did the Star-Spangled Banner. Francis Scott Key led John Randolph of Roanoke to Christ, converted him to Christianity. John Randolph became a strong advocate of Christianity, and I guess if people are worried about a Muslim in Congress today, that's the right tack to take, is conversion. And that's what John Randolph of Roanoke experienced through the witnessing of Francis Scott Key. So going back to Jefferson, Jefferson brings some peace to America from these terrorist attacks. And the next president comes in is James Madison. Now, Madison immediately gets engulfed with the War of 1812. He's having to defend America from this, what's called the Second American Revolution, but the British are attacking America again. And so that war goes for several years. And don't ever think that enemies overseas don't watch what's happening domestically in America, because when Madison went to war against the British, and the Navy is now tied up against the British Navy, all these Muslim terrorists overseas said, oh, look, they're busy. They can't do anything to us now. And so they started renewing all the same attacks that they had been doing a decade before, now knowing that the American military can do nothing to them. So we signed the peace treaty to end the War of 1812 and 1815. And as soon as Madison signs the peace treaty to end the war with the British, he immediately dispatches the American Navy back over to that same region of the world to deal with these Muslim terrorists. And so leading the expedition that time, you have two leaders. It's another two-prong attack. You have Commodore William Bainbridge, and you also have Commodore Stephen Decatur. Now, Stephen Decatur, who's the leader of the stuff that Madison sent over, Stephen Decatur had been a young naval lieutenant back when Thomas Jefferson sent him the first time in the War on Terror. So Decatur really showed himself as a great warrior at that point. Now he's being sent back 10 years later because he knows the turf. He knows the enemy. He's going back. And so Madison sent him back. And so for the next 2 years, it is brutal hand-to-hand combat with these terrorists. It's a lot like the urban kind of stuff that our guys have been having to do in cleaning out Baghdad and cleaning out Mosul and all these other places where that it's really this hard hand-to-hand close quarters combat. And so it was back then as well. There are very famous pictures of Stephen Decatur engaged in hand-to-hand conflict with these Muslim terrorists. And so after 2 years of just, again, thumping these guys, they say, okay, we give up America. We'll be nice. Please don't send your Navy back over anymore. Don't send the Marines back. We don't want to see them. We'll be nice. And so that brought to a conclusion that first war on terror. And it was Muslim terrorists. It was 32 years of conflict. It was 7 years of armed warfare on the ground in the same region where we are now under four different military commanders. It was not a small thing. We never hear about that in our history books. But, you know, if you say, now, why did they fight Americans back then? What was the cause? You'll recall that the diplomat told Adams and Jefferson, he says, we do this because it's founded on the laws of our prophet Muhammad. It's written in our Quran that all nations who should not acknowledge our authority are sinners, and it's our right and duty to make war upon them wherever they can be found, and every Muslim who's slain in battle is sure to go to paradise. Now, this is part of the theological belief, is that if you get killed in a holy war, you're going right to heaven. See, that one of the problems with Islam as far as going to heaven is you don't know if you're going to get there until after you die. You die, when you get there, the angels weigh up your good works, they weigh up your bad works, and if the good works outweigh the bad works, then you get to make heaven, but you won't know that till after you get there and those works are weighed. Now, if you want a guaranteed express ticket to heaven, what you got to do is get yourself killed in a holy war. And that's why the imams are so rapid to call for jihads, because once they declared a holy war, now if you get yourself killed, you're straight into heaven. That's your straight ticket in. What can be better than going to heaven? And guaranteed way to get there is to be killed in a war, a holy war, a war against Christians. So that's what was happening back then. That's still what is happening now. And by the way, another early Secretary of State was Timothy Pickering. He served under John Adams and George Washington. And if you look at the diplomatic correspondence to the State Department when he's Secretary of State, I thought one of the really compelling statements was this. And this was one of the statements that was sent in by one of the diplomats. He said, quote, "Taught by revelation that war with the Christians will guarantee the salvation of their souls, the Muslims' inducements to desperate fighting are very powerful." In other words, since they're taught in their holy book that if you war with a Christian and you get killed, that's a straight ticket to heaven. Man, that's a great inducement for them to fight very viciously, because that's a way to heaven. You're not going to talk them out of fighting. It's like trying to talk them out of their salvation. So when you look at where we are today and you say, now, why are these guys so insistent on fighting Americans? Well, let me just repeat what was said 200 years ago. Taught by revelation that war with the Christians will guarantee the salvation of their souls, the Muslims' inducements to desperate fighting are very powerful. Yeah, but why did they attack the World Trade Center? Why fly those planes into the largest office building in the world, where you have tens of thousands of civilians inhabiting that building? Why do that? Very simple. Taught by revelation that war with the Christians will guarantee the salvation of the souls, the Muslims' inducements to desperate fighting are very powerful. See, we think in terms of fighting war against military forces. They don't. They think in terms of fighting war against Christians. The war is Muslims against Christians, not military against military. That's the way Americans think. See, their thing is, hey, find a bunch of Christians, take them out, and if you get killed doing that, that's your straight ticket to heaven, as long as you're taking Christians out. And by the way, in America, all these secularists keep saying, oh no, we're not a Christian nation. Every other nation in the world believes America is a Christian nation except us. I mean, ask any Islamic nation, is America a Christian nation? And say, of course America is a Christian nation. So it's real simple. You attack America, you're attacking Christians, and if you get killed, that's a guaranteed ticket to heaven. Yeah, well, but why attack the Pentagon? Well, again, taught by revelation that war with the Christians will guarantee the salvation of their souls, the Muslims' inducements to desperate fighting are very powerful. Same answer answers every question. The same statement. You can use it again and again. And so people who say, well, we just need to sit down and negotiate and talk. And if we can just, no, that's like a Christian sitting down and having someone try to talk them out of going to heaven. You might do it. It's possible to do some occasions, but it's not very likely. So are we going to sit down with a different religion that believes the way to heaven is, now there's many ways to heaven for them, but a guaranteed way to heaven, I mean, the one way you can know for sure is to get killed in a holy war, and we're going to talk them out of their guaranteed ticket to heaven? Not likely. You see, that's why it did not work 200 years ago. It still doesn't work now. We negotiated, and finally said, all right, well, we got to do something different. And that's where Washington called for the military, and that's where we started using it. So when you look at where we are today, and one of the guys, by the way, who was run over by that 757 plane when it hit the Pentagon was Lieutenant Colonel Brian Birdwell. He was engulfed with jet fuel. He was set ablaze. He was a human torch. And amazingly, providentially, sovereignly, he survived that. 39 surgeries later, I mean, he was fried crisp, no skin left on his body, in places there were, but generally it was burned clean off. And as you see him today, if you see him, and he's got a great book, it's a book worth getting online and reading, it's Refined by Fire, Colonel Brian Birdwell. You see him, you look at him, he goes, yeah, I can see a little scar tissue around, but he looks pretty good. And then you read that his entire arm, from armpit to fingertips, is rebuilt and been grafted. His entire face, his ears, his eye sockets, his nose, all of that is reconstructed and grafted. I mean, there was nothing there. He was just fried. And so as he was overcome with that, he now has a wonderful testimony that he shares. And he's a strong Christian, strong believer, what God did on that day and how he managed to survive that. But Colonel Birdwell points out something that we often forget. War against terror commenced because of the attacks on the World Trade Center and the attacks on the Pentagon. When they flew those planes into these American buildings, we said, that's it, we're going to war. And we think that's what started it. But what we forget is that they had been attacking us for 30 years before that, and we were doing absolutely nothing to defend ourselves. Go back to 1979, the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, when they attacked and took the entire U.S. Embassy. And embassies are always considered home soil. They came onto American soil. When you step in a U.S. embassy in any country, you've stepped onto American soil. If you step into the Canadian embassy in the United States, you're on Canadian soil. If you step into Saudi Arabian embassy in the United States, you're on Saudi soil. I mean, that is international law. When you step into an embassy, you're on American soil. And they stepped onto American soil, and they took the entire embassy. And so that was, we didn't provoke that. That happened. Then you remember that 4 years later, the U.S. Embassy in Beirut was bombed. Now, I'm going to give you some figures of casualties here to remind you how many Americans were casualties. And this is not talking about all the nationals who live in those countries who were also killed and wounded. But in that 1983 U.S. Embassy bombing in Beirut where the terrorists attacked Americans, 17 Americans were killed, 100 were wounded. And again, that is on American soil. That same year, you had the attack on the Marine barracks in Beirut. And that attack was 242 American dead, 81 wounded. You also had the next year, the U.S. servicemen were attacked in Berlin by those terrorists. The nightclub there in Berlin, and they killed two Americans and wounded 79 others. And now, not counting all the Germans that were killed and wounded, but this is just American casualties. Then 1984, terrorists kidnapped and murdered Station Chief William Buckley. 1984, they attacked the U.S. Embassy annex in Beirut. In that attack, there were two dead and 21 wounded, not counting all the others in Lebanese that were killed. In 1984, the Muslims attacked the American Air Force Base in Torreon, Spain, killing 18, wounding 83 Americans. You may remember the 1985, the TW-8 flight 847. Famous pictures were that they found that American sailor on board, and they clubbed him to death and threw his body out on the tarmac. Terrorists did that. We also had the 1988 Pan Am flight bombing over Lockerbie, Scotland. We had 189 Americans killed in that bombing. We had the first attack on the World Trade Centers in 1993, 6 Americans dead, 1,000 Americans wounded. We had the 1996 attack on the Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia, 19 Americans dead, 372 wounded, and again, not counting the Saudis that were killed in that attack. 1998 attack on the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi by Muslim terrorists, we had 12 Americans dead, 6 wounded. Simultaneous attack on the U.S. Embassy in Tanzania where they wounded 7 Americans. We had the attack on the USS Cole in Yemen, 17 dead, that was in 2000, 17 dead, 39 wounded. And then we had the 9/11 attacks where that we had 3,030 dead and 2,337 wounded. Now, if you look, and those are just some of the attacks, that's not all. It's been going for 30 years. But if you look over that period of time, America took about 10,000 casualties in that period of time. Dead, wounded, we took about 10,000 casualties and did absolutely nothing in that period of time. So here we are back to exactly what they said about us 200 years ago. The Americans are a feeble sect of Christians. You either have to fight well or pay well, and these guys don't fight well, so we'll just keep making them pay. We'll just keep taking lives. So attack after attack after attack after attack, and finally at 9/11 we said, okay, we're not playing this game anymore, and we suddenly went on offense. Now, all those other years we were on defense, we lost 10,000 American casualties. Now we go on offense. Well, we still took some casualties, so the question is not whether you're going to have casualties. You're going to have them whether you're on offense or defense. But now that we've been on offense, oh, suddenly it's the fall of the Taliban, and you have an Afghan interim government, you have the Afghan Republic, you have the removal of Saddam. Libya decided to abandon its nuclear program because it didn't want to get invaded. You had interim government in Iraq. You had Karzai elected. You had Iraqi elections. You had the Iraqi constitutional vote, President Maliki. You get all these things that are happening now that were not there before. And the casualty numbers we have now are only about one-third of what we took in the 30 years before that. And we've actually been able to accomplish something. So Colonel Birdwell points out great stuff on that, that we forget all the attacks that have been going for years and years and years, just like it was in the American Revolution, attacks for years and years, nearly 20 years before we finally did something about it back then. It's been going that way now. And Colonel Birdwell, as he looks at that region of the world where we're fighting right now, he likens it really to a swamp. And he says, you know, he said, you can either learn to live with the mosquitoes that come out of the swamp, or one day you can decide that you're going into the swamp to drain the swamp and permanently take care of the mosquitoes. And that's really what the war on terror is about. We've been living with mosquitoes that have been coming out of that swamp, and now we've decided, okay, we're going to go in and drain that swamp and take care of the mosquitoes so that we don't have to keep doing this year after year after year after year. Yes, there are American casualties, but there were American casualties before we ever started this thing. So as you look across the war on terror, you need to remember that when you see the perception on the media, that's just one side. I go back to Proverbs 18:17. He who states his case first seems right until someone tells the other side of the story and sets the record straight. So when you think about the war on terror, remember that there is not only another side than what the media gives, but there's also a historical side and a spiritual side that still are very applicable to our today in the war on terror. God bless you.